as it dawned, morning, there were thunders and lightning. A great cloud settled on the mountain. The people trembled as they heard the voice of Elohim's own words, a sound.
Shalom Aleichem, Mishpat Kach, Todd Cameron here with Paradigm Shift, and thank you again so much for joining us today. As always, we want to give all glory, thanksgiving, honor, and praise and worship, and everything in of ourselves to the Father of our forefathers, Yahuwah El, who sits in the heaven of heaven, with our King, Yahushua HaMashiach, sitting at his right hand, waiting for his enemies to be made his footstool.
Yahuwah Sali, Umetu Dati, Umetavi Ali, Zuri Ekasebo. Yah is my rock, and my fortress, and my deliverer. My El, my rock, in whom I shall find refuge.
Hallelujah.
Why? Why? Why do you need refuge? Why do you need deliverance? Why do you need a fortress? Why?
So you won't be consumed. You won't be consumed.
Hallelujah.
By the fire he's bringing to cleanse this earth. That's why.
And we're going
every
on with
every man's heart's going to melt for fear of what's coming to pass on this earth. You're not going to stay on your knees at these times. You know, when mountains totally move out of their place and continents disappear and reappear. Abba says he's going to make man scarcer than fine gold on this planet, Mishpachah.
That kind of makes you take the Georgia Guidestones into different recognition. 500 million. Maintain the population under 500 million. Why would you want to do that? Oh, because it's easy to control.
Yeah,
7 billion is a little harder.
Yeah, that's their dream, is to be able to be in charge after the conflagration is, after the world is cleansed by fire this next time, but they are not going to make it. All these kings of the earth that have deluded us over all these centuries and over all these years, we are still in the dark ages, Mishpachah. We haven't come out of them. The light came into the world, and then as soon as the light was risen and taken up to the right hand of our Father in heaven, the dark ages began to ensue upon us.
That's right. All those pagan religions, all those demonic seething creatures started just to manifest and move back
ways.
On in. Yeah, that's right.
Find
it's all the
ways.
Same stuff.
And the ways they did it was to become mainly the gods of the monotheistic religions of the peoples of the earth.
The wolves in
sheep's clothing.
The synagogue of Satan.
The church of Satan. The synagogue for the Jews, the church for the Christians, and the mosque?
Yeah.
The mosque for the
Muslim.
Our brothers in Ishmael.
Because
I do say brothers in Ishmael, because he does love Ishmael. He gave them 12
princes,
and he said he loved Ishmael, and it says in Isaiah 19 that he's going to bring us all back together again to worship him only through Yeshua HaMashiach with one road between Syria, Israel, and Egypt.
Okay, so let's just get right into Velikosti here.
Get right
here.
Into Velikosti.
Where
so this is, oh wait, we didn't say what this is. This is part, we did?
Yeah.
This is part 20?
Uh-huh.
Okay, very good.
Okay. In Egypt, too, the great bear played the part of the pole star. So now we're talking about how the earth has actually changed and the heavens aren't static. The sun, moon, and stars have all switched around. The earth has switched around. It's reeled to and fro like a drunkard. That's what we're sitting here describing, okay?
The last time we left off with the ancients describing how the pole star changed from the great bear, the big bear, Arturius, of the satanic religions, into the smaller bear, the little tail, the north pole star.
The little bear. In Egypt, too, the great bear played the part of the pole star. The great bear never set. Could it be that the precession of the equinoxes shifted the direction of the axis so that 3,000 or 4,000 years ago the polar star was among the stars of the great bear? No. If the earth moved all the time as it moves now, 4,000 years ago the star nearest the North Pole must have been Draconis.
So I just want to
The change was sudden. The great bear came bowing down. In the Hindu sources, it said that the earth receded from its wonted place by 100 yojonas, a yojona being 5 to 9 miles. Thus, the displacement was estimated at from 500 to 900 miles.
There you go, Mishpachah. And it gives you a whole new understanding, possibly, of when the scriptures talk about that when the stars fall from the heavens. They literally fell on the horizon, Mishpachah.
Yes, yes.
That's right.
The origin of the pole.
And, oh, and the other thing is, again, over and over again, a big point to this is throw out all of man's calendars and witness the beginning of the year for yourself. Using your staff.
It's the only way to be on Abba's timing.
The only way to be on Abba's timing ever.
It's the only thing that man can't mess with.
That's right. You know, you witness the beginning of spring. You know how to do that with the staff.
It's the only thing
that's
regular and steady. You can count for it. Yep. Sorry.
You can navigate the earth. Buy it anywhere, any place, any time, any season, and you can know where you need to go in order to have to be able to have green fields and foods that you can support yourself with, and Abba can bless you with. Now, as far as your calendar and the times and seasons of Abba, there's no other way to do it through all these epochs that other than to witness what he has done with the heavens and the earth at any point in time.
And he does tell you that it rules the day. The greater light rules the day. So you got to choose. You want to do stuff in darkness and at night, or you want to do stuff during the day?
Hallelujah. It's like, you know, you get done with the day. Let's just talk about it for a second. In Genesis 1.
No, that's not. Okay, let's just keep going on this.
Okay,
the origin of the pole star is told to many traditions all over the world. The Hindus of the Vedas worship the polar star, Darura, the fixed or immovable. In the Puranas, it is narrated how Darura became the pole star. The Laps venerate the pole star and believe that if it should leave its place, the earth would be destroyed in a great conflagration. The same belief is found among the North American Indians. The day on which the shortest shadow is cast at noon is the day of the summer solstice. The longest shadow at noon is cast on the day of the winter solstice. This method of determining the seasons by measuring the length of the shadows was applied in ancient China as well as in other countries. We possess the Chinese records of the longest and shortest shadows at noontime. These records are attributed to 1100, the year 1100. But the shortest and the longest shadows recorded do not really represent the true lengths at present. The old Chinese charts record the longest day with a duration which does not represent the various geographical latitudes of their observatories, and therefore, the figures are supposed to have been those of Babylonia, borrowed by the ancient Chinese, a rather unusual conjecture. The length of the longest day in a year depends on the latitude or the distance from the pole and is different at different places. Gnomons or sundials can be built with great precision.
Gnomons,
okay. Mm-hmm. The Babylonian astronomical tablets of the 8th century provide exact data, according to which the longest day at Babylon was equal to 14 hours 24 minutes, whereas the modern determination is 14 hours 10 minutes and 54 seconds. The difference between the two figures is too great to be attributable to refraction, which makes the sun still visible over the horizon after sunset. Thus, the greater length of the day corresponds to latitude 34 by 57 and points to a place 2.5 degrees further to the north. We stand, therefore, before a strange riddle. One tries to decide. Either the tablets of System 2 do not originate from Babylon, though referring to Babylon, or the city actually was situated farther north, to the about 35 degrees away from the equator. Since the computations of the astronomical tablets did refer to Babylon, there is a possible solution that Babylon was situated at a latitude of 35 degrees from the equator, much farther to the north than the ruins of this city. Ptolemy, who in his Almagest made computation for contemporaneous and ancient Babylon, arrived at two different estimates of the longest day at that city, and consequently of the latitude at which it was marked, one of his estimates being practically of the present day value, the other coinciding with the figure of the ancient Babylonian tables, 14 hours 24 minutes. The Arabian medieval scholar Arzazkel computed from ancient codices that in more ancient times, Babylon was situated at a latitude of 35 degrees zero from the equator, while in latter times it was situated more to the south. Johannes Kepler drew attention to this calculation of Arzachel and to the fact that between ancient and modern Babylon, there was a difference in latitude. Thus, Ptolemy and likewise Arzachel computed that in historical times, Babylon was situated at a latitude 35 degrees. Modern scholars arrived at identical results on the basis of ancient Babylonian computations. Quote, this much therefore is certain. Our tables, System 2 and 1 also, and the astronomers mentioned as well, point to a place about 35 degrees north latitude. Is it possible that they were mistaken by 2 degrees to 2.5 degrees? This is scarcely believable. End quote. As there was but one Babylon, its location at some historical time at 35 degrees north latitude signifies that at the longitude of Babylon, the earth since then has turned toward the south, and the direction of the polar axis or its geographical location or both have undergone displacements.
Okay, I'd just like to say this real quick too, Mitch McKay, is that now you can have a little more understanding why the Vatican observatories, the world's largest observatories, are owned and controlled by the Vatican, the European Space Agency, and NASA. And now you can also understand why that being an astronomer in these days and times, especially since about the time of Velikovsky being alive and writing these books, going back to about the 40s and 50s, as astronomers has been being an astronomer has been the most one of the most deadly professions on the entire planet. Anyone who discovers anything and lets out the knowledge that they are actually seeing and looking for, which is because of the ancient knowledge that they do have and they've kept from us, is conveniently killed dead by car accidents, mysterious heart attacks, fast-acting cancer diseases, I don't know, murders, stranglings in their hotel rooms or at their homes, all kinds of crazy things, or a sudden suicide done by one of these guys, supposedly. So going on here, some of the classic authors knew that the Earth had changed its position and had turned toward the south. Not all of them, however, were aware of the real cause of this perturbation. Diogenes Laertius, Diogenes, there you go, repeated the teaching of Leucippus, whatever, quote, these Greeks got some weird names, quote, the earth was bent or inclined towards the south because the northern regions grew rigid and inflexible by the snowy and cold weather which ensued thereon. End quote. The same idea is found in Plutarch, who quoted the teaching of Democritus. The northern regions were ill-tempered, but the southern were well, whereby the latter, becoming fruitful, waxed greater, and by an overweight prepondered and inclined the whole that way. In Petaldalsis, quoted by Plutarch, taught that the north was bent from its former position, whereupon the northern regions were elevated and the southern depressed. Anaxagoras taught that the pole received a turn and that the world became inclined toward the south. As we have seen, Seneca in Theaetetus correctly ascribed the displacement of the pole to a cosmic catastrophe. Okay, the next portion is called Temples and Obelisks. In classic authors' references can be found to the fact that the temples of the ancient world were built facing the rising sun. We've talked about that with the Temple of Yah. We know that the gates, the pillars of the eastern gate faced east, and it shined so did the temple and the sun in the rising. For the reason why it was built that way is so that on the turn of the year day, which is the spring equinox, the sun would be right between the two pillars and shine directly into the holy place and the holy of holies, Mishpachah, so then they could mark the beginning and ending of the year. In classic authors, I lost this. And that they are temples or the sun. Orientation toward the sun is, at the same time, orientation toward the visible planets, as all of them travel through the signs of the zodiac or in the ecliptic. The sun changes the point of its rising and setting from one day to another, and the ecliptic makes a corresponding slow swing from one solstice to another. Therefore, the purposes of accurate observation of whether the terrestrial pole shifted in a sudden way, it was necessary to build the temple observatories, not only simply facing the east and west, but with a device that would permit checking the position of the sun on the days of the vernal and autumnal equinoxes, when the sun rises exactly in the east and sets exactly in the west. The Tractate Eruban of the Jerusalem Talmud records the surprising fact that the Temple of Jerusalem was so built that on the two equinoctial days, the first ray of the rising sun shone directly through the eastern gate. I just keep repeating myself here, don't I? Repeating his words. I forgot where he was going with this. The eastern gate was kept closed during the year, but was open on these 2 days for this very purpose. The first ray of the equinoctial sun shone through the eastern gate and into the very heart of the temple. There was no sun worship in this arrangement. There was, did you hear that? There was no sun worship in this arrangement. Not originally. Once we begin to fall away from the heart right ruling matters of what the Torah is actually for, we began to be enticed and we began to actually worship the sun. And we did that by looking to the broken reed Egypt during the time of Judges and the time of the kings. Okay, Mishpachah? Worship in this arrangement. It was dictated by the events of the past, when the position of the earth in relation to the rising and setting points of the sun was moved in world catastrophes. The fall equinox was observed as New Year's Day. This ceremony with the equinoctial sun was old. The Babylonian temples also had the gate of the rising sun and the gate of the setting sun, with the growing belief that there would be no more changes in the world system, a belief expressed also by Isaiah 66:22. The eastern gate of the Jerusalem temple was closed forever. It will be opened in messianic times. Although unaware of these ancient practices and literary references to the orientation of the temples, a writer of the end of the 19th century came to the conclusion that the temples of the ancient world faced the sunrise. He found considerable evidence in the position of temples, but he wondered also that there were deliberate changes in the orientation of the foundations of some older temples. Quote, the many changes in direction of the foundations at Eleusis revealed by the French excavations were so very striking and suggestive that the author asked whether there was possible astronomical origin for the direction of the temple and the various changes in end direction. Excuse me, Ms. Picot. Further investigation by other authors revealed the fact that generally only the temples of a latter time faced the east, and that earlier temples built before the 7th century had their foundations purposely directed the same orientation. Orientation can be traced in a number of archaic foundations away from the present east. Knowing by now that the earth repeatedly shifted the direction of the sunrise and sunset, we understand the changes in the orientation of the foundations as the result of changes in nature. Thus, we have in the foundations of the temples, like that of Eleusis, a record of the changing direction of the terrestrial axis and the position of the pole. The temple was destroyed by catastrophes and rebuilt each time with a different orientation. Besides the temples and their gates, the obelisk also served the purpose of fixing the direction of east and west, or of sunrise and sunset on equinoctial days. As this purpose was not perceived, the object for which the obelisks were built seemed enigmatic. The origin and religious significance of the obelisks are somewhat obscure. Two pillars were erected before the Temple of Solomon, but their purpose is not revealed in the scriptures. In America, obelisk pillars were built too. Sometimes a ring was set on the vertex of the pillar for the sun's rays to pass through. Quote, the solstices and equinoxes were carefully observed. Stone pillars were erected, 8 on the east and 8 on the west side of Cusco, to observe the solstices. At the heads of the pillars, there were discs for the sun's rays to enter. Marks were made on the ground, which had been leveled and paved. Lines were drawn to mark the movement of the sun. Quote, to ascertain the time of the equinoxes, there was a stone column in the open space before the Temple of the Sun, in the center of a large circle. This is Cusco, in Mexico, Mishpacha. The instrument was called Inhuatana, which means the place where the sun is tied up or encircled. There are Intihuatanas on the height of some temple at Pisac at Hatunokola and in other places. The Egyptian obelisk could serve as a gnomon or shadow clock. The length of the shadow in its direction would indicate the hour of the day. Obelisks placed in pairs served as a calendar. On the vernal and autumnal equinoxes, their shadows would be continuous for the length of the day, the sun rising exactly in the east and setting exactly in the west. That the purpose for which the obelisks were erected was to check on the shadow of the sun and the position of the earth can be plainly seen from the passage of Pliny. Quote, the obelisk of Sethothis, brought from Egypt that has been erected in the Campus Martius in Rome has been applied to a singular purpose by the late Emperor Augustus, that of marking the shadow projected by the sun, and so measuring the length of the days and nights. There then follows this remark, quote, "For nearly the last 30 years, however, the observations derived from this dial have been found not to agree, whether it is that the sun itself has changed its course in consequence of some derangement of the heavenly system, or whether that the whole earth has been in some degree displaced from the center, a thing that I have heard say has been remarked in other places as well, or whether that some earthquake confined to this city only has wrenched the dial from its original position, or whether it is that in consequence of the inundations of the Tiber, the foundations of the mass have subsided." The passage indicates that Pliny envisaged every possible cause, not excluding the one known to have occurred in earlier times when, in the language of Plutarch, quote, "the pole received a turn or inclination," end quote, or in the words of Ovid, quote, "Earth sank a little lower than her wonted place," end quote.
Okay, the shadow clock. The poles changed their locations. All latitudes were displaced. The axis changed its direction. The number of days in the year increased from 360 to 365 and a quarter, a fact demonstrated in a following section. The length of the day probably also altered. Of course, a sundial or shadow clock from before 687 can no longer serve the purpose for which it was devised, but it might well be of use in proving our assumption. Such a clock, originating from the period between circa 850 and 720, was found in Fajum, Egypt, at latitude 27 degrees. A horizontal slab with hour marks has at one end a shadow-casting vertical hob. This shadow clock cannot show correctly the change of time in Fajum or elsewhere in Egypt. A scholar who investigated its working came to the conclusion that it must have been kept with its head to the east in the forenoon and to the west in the afternoon, and several scholars agreed that this was the way to use the clock, but this arrangement by itself did not make it possible to read the time, since all actual hour shadows lie substantially closer to the hob than the corresponding marks of the instrument. The shadow-casting edge must have been higher over the shadow-receiving plane than we find it to be. The upper edge cannot be the shadow-caster of the instrument. It must have been on a parallel line above this edge. The marks were also not made on the basis of actual observations, but must have been taken from some theory or another. But, as a critic remarked, this theory implies that at no season of the year did the clock denote the hours correctly, without an hourly alteration of the height of that part of the instrument which cast the shadow. As the clock has no device to adjust the height of the head, it's improbable that this hourly manipulation took place. Besides, in order to change the height of the head every hour, in itself an impractical method, it would have been necessary to have another clock to show the hours without any manipulation, thus indicating the exact moment when the first clock had to be adjusted. But if there was a clock that could show the hours correctly without adjustment, what purpose did the shadow clock serve? Another explanation has therefore been offered for the manner in which the Egyptian sundial was used. The author of the new idea supposes that at some early date, the precession of the equinoxes being taken into consideration, the shadow clock was used at some latitude in Egypt on the day of the summer solstice. He admits, though, account has, however, not been taken of the change in the declination of the sun between sunrise and sunset. For other reasons of the year, it would be necessary at each hour or each clock reading either to alter the height of the hob or tilt the clock or both. Indeed, when the sun had south declination, and even when it had slight north declination, it would always be necessary to do both. The inference is, therefore, that the clock was originally used at or near the time of the summer solstice. The problem of adjustment for each reading once more crops up in this explanation, again requiring some better means of knowing the exact time. The conclusion at which the author of this explanation arrives, that originally the clock was built for a single day in the year, is rather odd and defies the very purpose for which clocks are constructed. And even if a clock were to be read only once a year, the author of this theory could not make the specimen found in Fajum work, but only a similar clock had been found broken in pieces. And this he could do only by having recourse to the precession of the equinoxes and by referring the clock to a period many hundreds of years earlier than chronologists assume. The shadow clock Zardakhshan, built under the Libyan dynasty between 850 and 720 before the present era, may help us to learn the length of the day, the inclination of the poles of the ecliptic, and the latitudes of Egypt in natural historical period. A change in any of these three factors would have made the clock obsolete as an instrument for time. And probably
we're
going to
have time.
Oh, it's not good.
I know, it's going to get a lot better from here, so keep looking up everything, Mr. God. We love you. Hallelujah.
You should not steal. You should not bear false witness against your neighbor. You should not covet.